the attacker had very good knowledge of banking systems.
$2.1 billion in stolen funds.
Money laundering operations.
A cyber criminal group.
These are smart guys.
From the BBC World Service, The Lazarus Heist is back for a brand new season.
Catch up with season one of the podcast now by searching for The Lazarus Heist, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
And get ready for season two, coming next week.
This is the Global News podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Saunderson, and at 14 hours GMT on Friday the 24th of March, these are our main stories. King Charles' state visit to France is postponed after violent protests there over pension reforms. India's opposition leader Rahul Gandhi is expelled from Parliament after his conviction for defamation. How a drawing by a Russian child sparked a police investigation. Also in this podcast...
Social media companies know their products are toxic. They designed their apps to be addictive. As leaders and as parents, we have a responsibility to protect our young people.
Utah becomes the first U.S. state to give parents control over their children's social media. And remembering the French pioneer of climate science, Claude Lorius, who's died. A planned visit to France by King Charles, his first state visit abroad as monarch, has been postponed after weeks of protests against raising the state retirement age took their most violent turn yet. Those were the sounds from Bordeaux overnight, where the town hall was set on fire. In Paris, police fired tear gas at protesters for the first time since the demonstrations began. More than 450 people were arrested and a similar number of police officers injured in the latest round of nationwide protests against the decision by President Macron's government to lift the age when French people can get their state pension from 62 to 64. Our royal correspondent Charlotte Gallagher told us more about the cancellation of the British Royals tour.
It was definitely an 11th hour decision, Valerie. There's no question that everyone thought this was going ahead. Some journalists had even travelled to France already to cover this trip. This will have taken months of planning. Money will have been spent. King Charles and the Queen Consort were due to be met in Paris with all the pomp and ceremony you'd expect from a state visit. They were going to ride along the Champs-Élysées. They were going to have a banquet at Versailles. But how would that have looked, firstly, the optics of that when you have these protests going on in the heart of Paris? And then also the security implications of having the British monarch in Paris and in wider France when you've got these protests going on, the police and the security services obviously stretched with that and then having to deal with a royal visit. So this was decision was made. It was the suggestion of President Macron to cancel this visit, postpone this visit even. And Buckingham Palace have agreed that now isn't the time. So they will be going ahead at some other point. They are still going to Germany, though. So this was a two-country trip. They were going to France, they were going to Germany. The German element of the trip is still going ahead, but there was just really no question that the French part had to be cancelled. It just wasn't possible.
Charlotte Gallagher. Speaking at a news conference in Brussels, President Macron condemned the violence and said he would not give in to it. So, just how bad has the situation in France become? I asked our correspondent Hugh Schofield in Paris.
The government is clearly hoping that the reality will set in and people will come to appreciate that unhappy they may be, but the law is the law and there's no real way of getting the government to turn back. And at that point, they will disgruntledly return to their ordinary lives. The atmosphere on the street kind of argues against that. Everyone you talk to who's out demonstrating, my neighbours here, are all saying this feels like it's one of those moments, you know, when the people of France, you know, get behind a cause and don't give up until they get some kind of victory. So right now, there's absolutely no way out of it. It is an impasse. There is going to be another big day on Tuesday. I've no doubt that the kind of confident mood that the protesters were projecting will continue then. They'll be out in force. And we'll just have to see which gives first. It really is a battle of strength now between the government, President Macron, and this sort of mass of the people. It's just one of those French episodes linked historically to the revolution when the people feel that they've got right on their side and they want to take down their head of state, their monarch, a peg or two.
Hugh Schofield in Paris. India's Congress Party has condemned the treatment of its leader Rahul Gandhi, who's been disqualified from Parliament after a court sentenced him to 2 years in prison for defaming the surname of Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Mr. Gandhi is out on bail and will appeal. The case goes back to 2019, when the opposition leader made the comments at an election rally. Here's Congress spokesman Abhishek Manu Singhvi.
There are some disturbing aspects of this judgment, which of course shall be subject to challenge proximately and immediately. Make no mistake, generally, all your attempts to create a chilling effect, a throttling effect, a strangulating effect on open, fearless speech relating to public interest will not stop either Rahul Gandhi or the Congress Party.
So, where does this leave Rahul Gandhi? Our South Asia editor Anbarasan Itharajan told us more.
Mr. Rahul Gandhi, who belongs to India's most influential political dynasty, he made a speech in 2019 during an election rally where he was talking about mentioning two Indian businessmen accused of financial mismanagement. They were on the run. And they also had a surname of Modi. So he was saying, how come all the thieves were having the surname of Modi? This is an indirect reference to the Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who he at that time was accusing of corruption. Then one of the members of the governing Hindu nationalist BJP from Gujarat state, from where Mr. Modi comes from, he filed a case saying that this had insulted the entire community because Modi, the surname is refers to a group of people. So he was asking for court's intervention and apology from Mr. Gandhi. And the case went on for 4 years and Mr. Gandhi refused to apologize. And that's why on Thursday, the court found him guilty and gave him 2 years of jail sentence. And he's on bail at the moment. He can appeal against this verdict. But this is quite an extraordinary political development in India. This comes at a time when many of the opposition parties are accusing the government of throttling free speech.
And is that how it's being seen there, that the Prime Minister is sending a warning to his critics?
Many opposition leaders have reacted strongly to even today's development about disqualifying Mr. Gandhi from Parliament. And Mamata Banerjee is a very senior opposition leader, Chief Minister of West Bengal state. And she was saying that opposition leader have become the prime target of BJP. And today we have witnessed a new low for our constitutional democracy. And quite a strong statements have come from various political parties. There has been ongoing row between the government and the opposition parties, and with the opposition parties accusing the government of using all the government's investigative agencies to targeting opposition leaders, jailing them on allegations of corruption and not allowing them to criticize the government's policies in parliament or in outside. They say the media is being controlled and media is being targeted, and their government is intolerant towards criticism. This has been the accusations by the opposition, which the ruling BJP strongly denies.
Anbarasan Itharajan. As the war in Ukraine continues, Russians who protest against their country's presence there take considerable risks in making their views known. They can lose their jobs, even their freedom. And in one town, a Russian man who's being prosecuted for anti-war posts on social media risks losing his daughter. Pressure on the family began last year after the girl drew an anti-war picture at school. From the town of Yefremov, our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg reports.
In the centre of Yefremov, there's a wall covered in pictures of war. Giant photos of masked Russian soldiers and the letter Z, symbol of the Russian offensive in Ukraine. This is the official patriotic picture of the invasion. But in this small town, another image of the Ukraine war has emerged. A very different one. In a social media video, a schoolgirl says that police have detained her father. Later, Masha Maskalyova was sent to a children's home. That was 3 weeks ago. But the story began last year with a picture 12-year-old Masha had drawn at school of a Ukrainian flag with the words "Glory to Ukraine" and a Russian flag with the words "No to War."
Так как я являюсь депутатом, то ко мне обращаются разные люди за всевозможные...
Town councillor Olga Podolskaya tells me that last year, Masha's father, a single parent, had contacted her for advice. He told her that his daughter's school, shocked by the drawing, had called the police.
Был очень ошарашен, так скажем.
The father, Alexei, was dumbfounded, Olga says, adding, the police began checking his social media, and they told him he was bringing up his daughter in a bad way. Outside an apartment block, a lawyer types in the entrance code. He's visiting Masha's father, who is now under house arrest. Since Masha drew that picture, Alexei, her dad, has been charged twice with discrediting the Russian army in anti-war social media posts. He could now be sent to prison. Separated from his daughter, he isn't even allowed to speak to her on the phone. His lawyer, Vladimir Bilyenko, says Alexei is distraught over Masha being put in a children's home. The social services seem obsessed with this family, Vladimir says. I think it's purely for political reasons. And what about Masha's school? Does it admit calling the police over a picture? School number 9 prides itself in a patriotic education. It recently invited Russian soldiers who were back from Ukraine into the classroom. The school director declared, "We believe in our motherland. It never makes mistakes." Sadly, she doesn't believe in speaking to us. The school hasn't responded to a written request for comment. So we go there. But they won't let us in. We try calling.
Алло.
Да.
Добрый день. Я ищу Ларису Александровну.
Same result.
Давайте все съедемся сюда и начнем.
Across town, supporters of the Moskalyov family gather in court. The local Juvenile Affairs Commission is taking legal action to officially restrict Alexei's parental rights. The commission has not responded to our written request to comment. Suddenly, an activist unfurls a poster. Return Masha to her father, it reads. A police officer tells her to take it down. Alexei isn't here for this preliminary hearing. He hasn't been allowed to leave house arrest to attend, even though what is at stake is whether his daughter will be allowed to come home.
Steve Rosenberg. We are no longer willing to let companies harm young people's mental health. The words of the U.S. state of Utah's governor, Spencer Cox, as he signed new laws restricting children's use of social media. People under the age of 18 now need their parents' permission before they can use apps such as TikTok, Facebook and Instagram. Parents will also have full access to their children's online accounts, including private messages. Utah is the first American state to bring in such a policy. Our reporter Azadeh Mashiri has been looking at what that means.
TikTok has been a big focus the last few weeks, but of course lawmakers and parents have been concerned for years about the impact social media is having on their children's mental health. Parents have been worried about the way children view their own bodies after being exposed to social media, about whether they're being exposed to harmful content, particularly self-harm content. And the big problem is a lot of parents just simply feel powerless as these apps have become more addictive. And that's exactly the goal that lawmakers have with this legislation. It's to give some control back to parents, and they do that in three specific ways. The first is that children and minors under 18 can no longer, once this bill comes into place next year, create accounts on social media apps like Instagram and Facebook and Snapchat and, of course, TikTok. They can't create those accounts without permission from their parents or their legal guardian. They also will have a social media curfew that parents can adjust, but the default is 10:30 p.m. to 6:30 a.m. And the third way, and this is the most controversial part of it, is that parents would now have complete access to their children's accounts, their messages, their posts, their replies, and therefore that does raise some privacy concerns.
There will be parents listening to this who are delighted with this, think that this is a great idea. However, there are plenty of people who would disagree. I mean, what are the main criticisms of this and how has this gone down with young people?
So I've spoken to several civil liberties experts, and what they've said is that they're very concerned about what this means for First Amendment rights, for free speech, because children also have a right to that, that it could infringe upon their privacy. And I spoke to one advocate for LGBTQ plus rights, and his concern was that a lot of children from those communities who are vulnerable, who perhaps can be in abusive homes and feel like they don't have anywhere they truly belong, social media can actually be a really good outlet for them, but also connect them to people that understand them. And this would cut them off from that. Now, I've also spoken to a spokesperson for Meta, who owns is the parent company for Facebook. And they say they've been working with lawmakers to try and ensure there are age verification tools, technology to protect children from harmful content, and that they do manage to capture a lot of that content before it's even reported. But as far as lawmakers are concerned, that's just not enough.
Azadeh Mashiri. Still to come.
The sea's my happy place, best place in the world for me. It's like being back in the military, having all these military people around you, all the banter.
The Iraq War veterans finding comfort through sailing.
Love Janessa is the true crime podcast from the BBC World Service and CBC Podcasts, investigating the murky world of online romance scams.
She was trying to get me to send her money.
Catch up with the whole series now. Search for Love Janessa wherever you found this podcast.
You win their hearts, you win their wallets.
Described as one of the world's most wanted fugitives, Do Kwon, a South Korean cryptocurrency entrepreneur, has been arrested in Montenegro in Europe after being accused of orchestrating a multi-billion dollar fraud that shook global crypto markets last year. Many investors lost their life savings. South Korea will also seek his extradition, and he faces fresh criminal charges in the United States. Do Kwon is also a wanted man in Singapore, from where our reporter Nick Marsh tell me more.
Do Kwon founded a trading platform, a blockchain platform called Terraform Labs back in 2018. And it's one of the many, many hundreds, maybe even thousands of these kinds of platforms that have sprung up in the last few years. It was based here in Singapore, actually, and that's why the Singaporean authorities are one of the many who were after him. The controversy started last year when the platform crashed. Two of the currencies that it offered, one was called Luna, one was called Terra USD, they pretty much lost all their value. So just like that, within the space of a week, $40 billion was lost. And what Mr. Kwon is accused of doing by prosecutors is misleading investors. So luring customers into buying a cryptocurrency that, you know, wasn't pegged to a stable asset like he claimed. The Terra USD was supposed to be pegged to the dollar. In the end, it ended up being unpegged, and then its value was completely lost. And since then, he went on the run. And now he's finally been arrested after several months going across the world trying to evade law enforcement.
Well, a lot of international law and enforcement wants to speak to him. It's not just Montenegro, is it?
Yeah, that's right. The US law enforcement has already hit him with several charges of fraud. The South Koreans have as well. Singaporeans here have. He left South Korea last year. He actually came here very briefly and was off again. The last place he was seen before his arrest today was Serbia, so next door to Montenegro. The Montenegrin authorities actually found him looking to get onto a flight to Dubai with a forged fake passport. They managed to cross-reference his fingerprints with the South Korean police agency records, made sure it was him, and now it looks like he's going to be extradited to South Korea. We don't know exactly what he's going to be charged with or when the kind of criminal proceedings begin, but we'll have to see what other law enforcement authorities want to try and do as well. It looks like there's going to have to be some kind of agreement reached between countries and their various authorities too.
Nick Marsh. Israel's Attorney General has accused the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, of violating a conflict of interest deal that's allowed him to take office while still on trial over corruption charges. Mr. Netanyahu, who's been visiting the UK, is pushing ahead with controversial reforms that would limit the power of the courts, leading to huge, almost daily protests across Israel. Our Middle East analyst Sebastian Usher reports.
In a harshly worded letter sent to Mr. Netanyahu this morning, the Israeli Attorney General Gali Barav Miara said that the legal situation was clear and he must refrain from involvement in any initiatives to change the judiciary. This is the issue that has convulsed the country for 3 months. After another day of mass protest against the proposal on Thursday and amid rumours of a possible split within his cabinet, Mr. Netanyahu went on television in a bid to reassure Israelis that he was doing everything possible to reach a solution acceptable to all sides. The Attorney General has now escalated her showdown with the Prime Minister, saying that his statement was illegal.
Sebastian Usher. Climate concerns have become such a big part of our lives that it's difficult to imagine a time when those fears simply didn't occur to anyone. But 60 years ago, a French scientist in Antarctica was sipping a glass of whiskey when he hit upon an idea that ended up proving that humans were responsible for global warming. Claude Lorius, who's died at the age of 91, led more than 20 expeditions to study glaciers, and his discoveries fundamentally changed our understanding of the environment. Daniel Mann looks back at his life.
It was his love of adventure which set Claude Lorius on the path to identifying and predicting an impending catastrophe for the planet. In 1956, just out of university, he joined an expedition to Antarctica. Temperatures there were as low as minus 40 degrees Celsius. Despite this, Lorius and two other people lived there for 2 years, surviving with limited supplies and a faulty radio. The more polar expeditions he led to the icy southern continent, the more he became fascinated with Antarctica's mysteries. In 1965, Lorius had a revelation by gathering ice samples and dropping them in whiskey. He spoke about it half a century later.
Un soir, après des travaux de forage en profondeur, nous avons bu dans notre caravane un verre de whisky.
One evening, after deep drilling, in our caravan, we drank a glass of whiskey in which we'd put ice cubes of old ice. Seeing the bubbles of air sparkling in our glasses, I came to the idea that they were samples of the atmosphere trapped in the ice.
Realising the scientific potential of analysing trapped air, he then decided to study ice cores, samples drilled out of the ice which act as frozen time capsules. By drilling into the ice, Lorius drilled into the past, penetrating, in his words, the ice of the first ice age. His research showed that while carbon dioxide had varied slightly, after the Industrial Revolution, concentrations of the greenhouse gas had rocketed as temperatures rose. The French National Centre for Scientific Research said this left no room for doubt that global warming was due to man-made pollution. From then on, he became a campaigner, and in 1988, he was the inaugural expert of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The life of Claude Lorius was one of discovery. He once said, "I did not choose science, I chose adventure."
Daniel Mann. 20 years ago this week, the US began its invasion of Iraq. Hundreds of thousands of soldiers, militants and Iraqi civilians were killed in the ensuing war. And thousands more were scarred physically and mentally by the fighting. Here in Britain, a charity has been helping veterans heal by taking them sailing. Caroline Hawley joined them aboard.
I'm out on a sailing sloop in Falmouth Bay with several military veterans, all of whom have been profoundly affected by serving in Iraq. It's grey and it's cold, but for all of them, they say this is a really important place.
My name's Sean Pascoe. I'm an A&E nurse by background. I worked on the back of Chinooks on a medical team called Merck.
Sean was later diagnosed with PTSD. He set up the charity Turn to Starboard to help other struggling veterans after sailing helped him find a way out of the darkest point of his life.
I was no use to anybody, and I had some really awful negative thoughts. I never actually, you know, attempted to kind of take my own life, but I certainly thought about it.
Sean had seen and experienced too much.
Multiple casualties of significant injuries, yeah, absolutely life-changing, multiple deaths. Some of the decisions I had to make that, you know, were really challenging, that actually, you know, with limited resources, right location, sometimes you had to say no. You know, that was really, really hard. Certain incidents now, I don't want to say them out loud because they're, you know, deeply upsetting.
Thousands of veterans have now sailed with Sean's charity, and two decades on, veterans of Iraq are still coming to it for help.
My name's Janet Riddell. I served as a Royal Navy Petty Officer Writer. Weekly, we did trips to the international zone to change money. On the way back in the Black Hawk, we were taken down by small arms fire, badly damaging my leg.
She lost both her leg, which had to be amputated, and the job she loved when she had to be medically discharged.
I fitted into Civvy Street okay. I still have my anger issues. I still have my nightmares, which I still have today. I still have nightmares today, which I struggle with. I only sleep about 3-4 hours a night. But I always see the world as, do you know what, there's always somebody there that's worse off than yourself.
And when you look back now on the Iraq war, how do you feel about it?
I don't see the point, personally, of wars, any wars, because nobody ever wins a war, do they? Well, that's my opinion anyway. I don't think anybody ever comes out of it with anything, to be honest with you. It's just a lot of pain and suffering.
Jan says being back at sea has made a huge difference to her mental health.
The sea's my happy place, best place in the world for me. It's like being back in the military, having all these military people around you, all the banter.
2-6, hey!
And it's helping many others to turn their lives around too.
Right, slow on the throat.
Caroline Hawley reporting. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, and you can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Rohan Madison. The producer was Chantal Hartle. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.